All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. This is going to be interesting today, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be hearing from the film of Bob Vakian's speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And that clip is, why do people come here from all over the world? And it has particular significance given what's going on in terms of the detention of the children crossing the border and being sent to these jails, held for who knows how long, and now being deported with Obama rushing to deport them as quickly as possible back to death and devastation in the countries that they tried to escape from, the countries that the U.S. has screwed up. So we're going to be listening to that piece, and it's a really, really provocative and important piece to listen to these days. And in the middle of the show, we're really pleased to be welcoming Keith David, actor in film and theater, and you've seen him in scores of films. He's played all kinds of very significant roles on Broadway and in other theaters. And he's going to be joining us to do a reading of Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be welcoming back Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the site revcom.us. And she's also an initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women, and stoppatriarchy.org. I wanted to have Sansara on the show, especially given what's been happening over the last few weeks. Just the already intense war on women has escalated dramatically, with two recent Supreme Court rulings seem to keep rolling right out. The court banned sidewalk buffer zones outside abortion clinics, giving a green light to cruel and hateful intimidation of women and caregivers. They've done all kinds of other rulings. They're hammering against women, really stepping up this war. And Sansara is joining us to talk about all this, its significance, both in their own right, but also importantly, in terms of the overall direction of society these days. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm glad to be back with you.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into it. You know, if you ever had any questions about the war on women and what's going on in this, you're sitting there and you pick up the newspaper, and there's not a day that you pick up the newspaper that you don't find some new aspect of this being rolled out from the Supreme Court. It was, I think, for a lot of people, very surprising in some ways, and really kind of people just stunned by what's happening. Can we talk about sort of your take on what's been going on with the Supreme Court?
First, I have to say I'm really glad that you are having somebody come in and read the Frederick Douglass speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July, because it cannot go unacknowledged. Just as this country was founded in exploitation, slavery, genocide, and oppression, I think the last week of Supreme Court rulings has just underscored this is a system that has never been in the service of the people. But, you know, a lot of people think that women have achieved their equality, women have no barriers in front of them anymore. Maybe there's a few dark ages and backwards men out there in some places, but basically women are moving forward. And I think, A, that's not the case, and B, we just saw in the last week with these rulings you're describing, the Supreme Court put its stamp of approval and the backing of the state, and the highest court in the land has said that it's okay for hateful, terroristic Christian fascists to harass, harangue, intimidate, and threaten women and doctors outside of abortion clinics. This is in a country where 8 people have been murdered by anti-abortion fanatics, that it's okay for those protesters and harassers to have free rein outside of clinic doors. That's the first ruling. Second ruling is to say that it's perfectly admissible for Christian fundamentalists, Christian fascists, and other religious bigots who have corporations that employ all kinds of people, not even just religious-based organizations, but employ broad public and serve the broad public, to say, I'm against birth control, so therefore nobody who works for me should be able to have access to it, and to immediately deprive many thousands of women of access to birth control, but actually set a precedent that could be used to argue much more restrictive, much more wide-reaching, much more all-encompassing, bigoted, theocratic, reactionary, really dark ages morality to be imposed and protected by the state. This is a time of incredible danger for women. And a lot of people were hoping that the Supreme Court was going to be the bastion of defense against what's been an all-out assault in the legislatures and the courts around the country on women's right to abortion and birth control. And here the Supreme Court came back and has sent a powerful message that this is a court and a system that is hostile to women. I think there's no other way to put it.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, it's like, you know, and it's true. You look at this, and it's, as I was saying, you know, I literally woke up this morning and looked at the newspaper, and bam, there's another ruling coming out where a college, a Christian college, is now allowed to, basically, they don't have to provide contraception themselves because they're Christian. And even though it's part of the Obamacare law that they have to do this, they've just been given at least a sort of, okay, we're going to give you, we're going to, we'll let you have a little rest on that, and we'll check it out later. But it was actually ruled that they can, in fact, for the moment, deny women, young women, the right to contraception under that medical care. One of the things I wanted to talk about, too, though, is that, and you mentioned this thing about, you wrote recently something commemorating or talking about the anniversary, the first anniversary of the Wendy Davis filibuster of the anti-abortion restrictions in Texas, something that really got a lot of people very excited, got a lot of support, was really in the midst of a whole sort of what appeared to be a sort of surge of people standing up and saying, no, no way are you going to get away with this. And it's the 1 year anniversary, and it's kind of, there's that irony there of all these things rolling out of the Supreme Court, this anniversary coming up. You wrote something talking about what actually was the significance of that, and what are the things that people need to learn from that? And I think that has a lot to do with how we're looking at these rulings that are coming out today as well.
Yeah, it is about 1 year since there was that major outpouring in Texas. And people need to remember that what was at stake is there was a bill that was introduced that was one of the most restrictive, far-reaching assaults on women's right to abortion anywhere in the country. It was a bill with four major measures. One would require abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a local hospital, which is totally medically unnecessary, but also very hard to do and was aimed at closing clinics. Another element of it was banning abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, which is the point at which many of the very dangerous fetal abnormalities actually aren't detectable before then. And so it's a very life-saving and necessary thing for women to be able to have access to abortion after 20 weeks, besides the fact that it's very hard for women to travel to get the money together. Many women don't know they're pregnant. Women need access to abortion at every stage of pregnancy without restriction, without shame, without apology. But that was going to be restricted. There was also a restriction that would require every abortion facility to comply with the requirements of sort of a mini emergency room, an ambulatory surgery center, which is totally unnecessary but financially prohibitive because most of these buildings were built with the kind of care that they provide in mind. Abortion is 10 times safer than childbirth. It's perfectly admissible for people to give birth in their own homes. Abortion is way more safe than that. And yet they're going to require these buildings to overhaul and comply with basically cost-prohibitive, medically unnecessary standards that will close down tons of clinics. And the fourth would be restrictions, drastic restrictions, medically unnecessary restrictions on the ability of women to access medication abortions, which are one of the most safe and simple ways for women to get an abortion. And so taken together, this was a major threat to women's access and ability to decide for themselves if they're going to have a child or if they're going to be forced to have a child against their will. And there was a major outpouring, many, many hundreds of people, and then it grew to thousands of people. And in the context of that, Wendy Davis stepped forward and staged a very, very electrifying filibuster for 13 hours. She did a filibuster to try to prevent the passage of that bill. And people all over the country were electrified by this. They were inspired by this. But what most people don't know, 1 year later, and there were major celebrations held throughout Texas of the 1 year anniversary of the Wendy Davis filibuster. But what most people don't know is that even as that law was prevented in its immediate passage that day, it was reintroduced and it was passed. 2 years ago, there was 46 abortion clinics in Texas. By September, there will be six of them left. This has had a dramatic, devastating impact on the lives of tens of thousands of women, millions of women in Texas. There are 26 million women in Texas. Women are backed up. The clinics are backed up. Women can't get abortions without weeks of waiting, without hundreds of miles of travel, without all kinds of undue burden. And this is rolling forward. And so when these celebrations were held and I heard that people were celebrating, it was very disturbing to me. And I thought, what are the real lessons? The real lessons are, one, tens of thousands of people in Texas alone and millions across this country are willing to step up and put a lot on the line to fight for abortion. It's very important. If we look at what happened, many people stepped out and fought, and they raised their voices, they traveled to Austin, they took over the Capitol. It was very powerful. So there is a reservoir of people who are willing to fight for this if they see what's at stake and they see a way to make a difference. That's a very important lesson, and we should not lose sight of that. Two, the fact is, despite this outpouring, these laws went forward, the clinics are closing, and we really have to take to heart that it's not acceptable to rely on the official political channels. That has proven to be a disaster. Everybody went home after this was done. They rolled largely into the campaign to elect Wendy Davis. That's not going to stop this assault. We have to get out there. We have to wage massive, independent political resistance. We have to fight this ourselves and not wait for the courts, as the Supreme Court just, it's like, smacked people in the face with once more. these courts are not on the side of women. They're not on the side of the people. We're not going to rely on the courts. We cannot rely on the politicians. We need to wage massive resistance. And there's a call for people to actually do that. That's sort of the third point, is that people have to step out of the tried and failed routine of the last several decades of just, you know, hoping somebody else will take care of this. And we have to put ourselves on the line to fight against the enslavement of women, which is what forced motherhood is. And this summer, that's why I'm part of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, actually going to Texas.
Let me just give an identification here, and we'll get into that. But I want to remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and the site RevCom.us, and an initiator of End Pornography and Patriarchy, The Enslavement and Degradation of Women, and StopPatriarchy.org. Sansara, as you're talking, I'm thinking, okay, this need for massive resistance. When you look at this thing, at the stuff that's been rolled out in the Supreme Court, the whole idea that it's on one hand very directly this assault against women, around abortion, and assault against women, the attacks on the humanity of women, this whole question of what kind of society are we going to live in? And then there's the point about what do you do about it? And when people look at that, it's interesting because I was reading Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent on one of these rulings. And I thought, it shows you how much roiling is going on when here's one of the Supreme Court justices writing one of the most scathing, I think, dissents in the recent history of the Supreme Court. But still, going along with everything, a lot of commentators have been saying there's been a lot of unanimity and amity and not sudden dissent during these Supreme Court rulings. You've posited that people need to get out and stand up and resist. And one of the things that you've been talking a lot about, and we need to talk a whole lot more about, is what the plans are for Texas. And I'd like to ask you to get into that, but also to talk about why Texas is actually the focal point of this, and then talk about what you're calling for.
And then at some point, I want to get back to Wheaton College just for a second. Or I'll just slide it in now. I have a special Jones. It's a Christian fundamentalist school, and I grew up with kids from Wheaton. I just have to say, I went to church camp with them. I spent, you know, a lot of time with kids there and other places. And I remember when this is related to your question, but this was the ruling from the Supreme Court this morning, the decision to grant Wheaton College exceptions to birth control. But I remember when the first abortion doctor was killed in the 90s. I was Christian at the time, and I'm an atheist and a communist now, but I was a Christian at the time. I wasn't a fundamentalist, but I hung out in the Young Life Club, and I hung out with kids who were, and I remember when the doctor was killed, some of my best friends had more sympathy with the gunman than with the doctor, because they really believed that abortion was the murder of babies and that killing doctors was permissible and was preventing some kind of Holocaust. And this is the way that kids are brainwashed. I mean, good friends of mine, this is very disturbing to me. They're brainwashed like this, and it relates to the buffer zone, too, because just this week, I read reports of people showing up after this buffer zone was struck down, showing up at the only clinic in North Dakota with signs that advocated the murder of abortion doctors. This is still an era that we live in, a very real danger. And so that's one future that's laid out when you talk about what's at stake. There's a future, literally, of forced motherhood and where women themselves, as well as men, are indoctrinated to believe that women's role and duty is to bear children and obey their husbands. And I know what that looks like. It's a horrific nightmare. And there's another future where actually we stand up and we defeat this, where we say women are full human beings, where women should not be reduced to being sex objects and raped and plundered in that way, where women should not be reduced to being breeders and owned and possessed and reduced to that. Look, being a parent can be beautiful. Having sex can be wonderful if you want it, if it's on terms that are respectful, that are the way you want it to be. But if you're forced to do either of those things, there's almost nothing more enslaving and degrading. And I just think that's what's at stake, not just for individual women, but for the kind of society that we're going to have and the way half of humanity will be treated. And so to come back to Texas, this is a ground zero. It's a concentration. It's not the only place the assault on women is taking place. There's six states with only one abortion clinic left. There's hundreds of laws being passed around the country. There's rulings at every level of court, including the Supreme Court, that are aiming to slam women backwards. But Texas really concentrates a lot because it is such a dramatic situation where they're going to be down to just six clinics after they had 46 clinics just 2 years ago. And a lot is concentrated in a trial that's taking place on August 4th in Austin that'll determine if these closures go forward. And our view is we cannot wait for the courts to rule. We cannot hope that some politician will save us. We have to go down to Texas. We have to shine the light of the whole country on what's happening there, and we have to rally people around the country and in Texas to stand up and create a political situation with our voices, with our acts of courage and resistance, with our truth-telling, with our coming together in public, where the courts do not feel that they can get away with closing any more clinics, and where we start to change the momentum and trajectory and the thinking and the actions of millions of people throughout this country so we begin to turn the tide nationwide. So we're bringing people down to Texas for the entire month of August, going into September, because we're going to be there. If they close those clinics, we're going to be there to lead people to stand up, to say we will not accept this, to engage in all forms of resistance, nonviolent direct action, all kinds of ways that people reject and refuse to go along with that. But through the month of August, we're going to be in Houston. We're going to be in Austin for the trial and beyond. We're going to be in San Antonio, and we're going to go down to the Rio Grande region near the border, where all the clinics have been closed and where there's this incredible crisis, children and others being detained at the border who are trying to immigrate, and that interpenetrates with this war on women in a very ugly way, and we're going to stand up against all of that. And we're going to do public hearings every Wednesday night. People can tune in around the country and send in their testimony to be read at them. There'll be live webcasts, and you can come down to Texas. We'll do a hearing in each of these cities that paints the picture of what this really means to real women's lives. We're going to have people testify what has happened to their lives, what happened before Roe, the stories that have been buried, and what is going on today with the providers, the threats they go through, the restrictions they have to surmount, with the women, with the families, and with religious leaders, atheist leaders, all kinds of public figures who are going to come and say, we do not accept this. Every Wednesday night, people should tune in around the country and be part of following this and sending down your testimony. And then every Thursday after that, in each of these cities, we're going to go out with the faces, the pictures and portraits of the women, the real women who have died from illegal abortions. We're going to have the hangers covered in blood that represent what women, when women used to be forced to use coat hangers to induce abortions, and they would die from this. And they're returning to those days today. And we're going to have the shackles that represent female enslavement. And we're going to go and confront the institutions and the individuals in their offices and other places in very public ways who are behind this war on women and call it out for what it is. We're not seeking common ground. We're not trying to draw some middle ground with people who hate women. We are defeating this war on women. We are fighting to wake others up that this is what's at stake. So we're going to do that throughout the month. People can follow along. People can come down. If you know people in Texas, contact them to open their homes to the volunteers, to join us in the streets, to send in their testimony. I know there are listeners who have stories, their own stories, or friends that died, or relatives that they know who had to go through illegal abortions before Roe v. Wade, or who had their lives foreclosed by forced motherhood. Send those in. Write it down. Take a page. Take 20 minutes. Write it down. Send it in to stoppatriarchy@gmail.com. Send it in and be part of making those who want to take this right away answer for this and help wake others up. We're doing fundraising. People can support in many different ways. And in the final week of August, we are going to do a week of defiance where we call on people who've been following this throughout the month, watching, tuning in every week, and who've been spreading the word where they are with the stickers, with the social media, with many different ways. We're calling on everybody to join us in going out in the streets, in your town, across this country, in major public rallies and smaller rallies in many different ways, to go out in public and say we stand against what is being done to women in Texas, and we see that it is about what's going to happen to women everywhere across this country. It's time for a national counteroffensive fighting against the enslavement of women and for abortion on demand and without apology, and building the momentum to actually win the full liberation of women. And I just have to say, I know we're going to wind up, but there's been a war progressing and advancing for decades against women, but it has never been as dangerous, as far along, and as urgent as it is right now. And really, this is a question. People are told that to be happy, you have to go buy this or that product, or to have a life with meaning, you have to bow down to this or that God, or get ahead most often by beating out or beating down somebody else. I want to say what really has meaning, what really can bring joy, not only to yourself, but to women everywhere and to humanity as a whole and future generations, is to look at this, not turn our heads from it, and take responsibility and step up and be part of fighting to change this. At this moment in history, you can and you have a responsibility to be part of making sure that the future is not one of forced motherhood. It's one where we beat this back, and in the process we change ourselves, we raise people's sights, we inspire people, we change the culture, and we create a movement that can go forward to actually win the entire liberation of women. That's what we have before us. That would have meaning. It would have tremendous meaning. Or we could allow really untold suffering to go forward, and that's on us. So I invite and I challenge everybody to join with us, because we don't have to accept this. and stop patriarchy, and many other people are joining together, and we have a vision and a plan to defeat this, so you have a role to play.
All right, Sansara, you know, we got to make a plan ourselves on keeping you each week while you're going through this thing in Texas, while you're implementing all this in Texas, that we can have you each week on the show to give an update on what's happening. That's another way people can actually follow it from here. But you can go to revcom.us and you'll find a lot there about this, as well as stoppatriarchy.org. Sansara, thank you very much for joining us today.
Michael, it's been my pleasure.
Okay, take care now. Talk to you again. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, as well as one of the initiators of End Pornography and Patriarchy, The Enslavement and Degradation of Women, and StopPatriarchy.org. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Keith David, and we're going to be listening to Keith's reading of Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July, so stay tuned.
Don't be no country. Another psychopath in Iowa, loading up another round, while the NRA and Columbine hunt Marilyn Manson down. Powder in the Pentagon, crew letters in the mail. Some KKK white supremacist cooking up a dose of race aid.
Don't be no country.
All right. Welcome back. That's, guess what? That's Alabama 3. All right, with Flag. Okay, that's a Flag, Half Mast Mix. And Alabama 3, check this out. They're the people, when you used to watch The Sopranos, they were the people that did that opening theme song for The Sopranos. They are an amazing group, all right? Just, they always surprise me, always surprise me. And this was one thing I thought was particularly relevant for today. Well, I'm very pleased to be welcoming to the show my next guest. His name is Keith David. He's an actor of really, really fine actor in both film and theater. And he recently completed weeks of portraying Paul Robeson on stage at the Ebony Theater. He's also, I understand you're going to be playing Frederick Douglass in an upcoming film?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I am.
Well, welcome to the show, man. Welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure. This Frederick Douglass speech, I know a mutual friend of ours suggested to you and then said to me, hey, would you, you always do this thing on Frederick Douglass, but would you be interested in having Keith read it? And she said that you were very, very pleased to be doing that. And I wanted to ask you just before you read it, What is the meaning of this? Why were you so moved by this speech from Frederick Douglass?
Well, I mean, Frederick Douglass and everything he stood for, today is as relevant as it was then. And that, to me, is shocking and amazing. But his insight into American politics, American policy, and his understanding of the Constitution and what it means to us and what it doesn't mean to us is just, it's so... It's profound. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, what he says in this speech, as I said, is as relevant today as it was then. What amazes me is that he delivered this speech before a completely white audience, and nobody left. So they had to be listening to something, and it's not angry. It just is.
You know, one of the things that gets me too, though, is, and this is what I was thinking about when I was thinking about, do I want to do this speech again and have someone come in and read it? You know, I woke up one morning and I saw the headline that 3,000 people a week in Detroit are being denied water. Mm. You know, and that's not just like random people. It's a concentration of black people in Detroit that are being denied water, basic water. The statistic that 1/3 of all black males born now, and that figure includes all those young black boys who were born 13 years ago, so 13 now, to those who are being born today, can expect to spend some portion of their life in prison in this country. And then you look at what's going on, this ugly stuff that's going on out at Murrieta, out in Riverside with the
attacks. Just heard about that,
intense. And these children either being kept in prison in inhumane conditions or being sent back to places where death is really not like a, it's not like, oh, maybe yes, maybe no. There's actually a very good chance these kids will die, if not being killed directly, from the conditions that they're being forced to go back into. You know, it's a horrifying thing. And when I thought about this thing with Frederick Douglass, what it really raises to me is that the whole idea, what he's calling out there, is the fact that this country was then practicing dehumanization and continues to this day to practice dehumanization.
And promises tomorrow to do the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And what we need is to emancipate all humanity and stop this stuff. You know, so it's sort of, that's it. So why don't we jump into this? I'm really anxious to hear you do this reading, man.
Well, here we go. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon here to speak today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, for both your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as an hart. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join in your joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct, and let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the example of a nation whose crimes, lowering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrecoverable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song. And they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and with the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command, and yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice, or who is not at heart a slaveholder, shall not confess to be right and just. But I fancy I hear some of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists fail to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. The slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of laws for their government. They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? The manhood of the slave is conceded. It is admitted in the fact that Southern statute books are covered with enactments forbidding, under severe fines and penalties, the teaching of the slave to read or to write. When you can point to any such laws in reference to the beasts of the field, then may I consent to argue the manhood of the slave. When the dogs in your streets, when the fowls of the air, when the cattle on your hills, when the fish of the sea and the reptiles that crawl shall be unable to distinguish the slave from a brute, there will I argue with you that the slave is a man. For the present, it is enough to affirm the equal manhood of the Negro race. Is it not astonishing that while we are plowing and planting, reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks, merchants, and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, orators, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manner of enterprises common to other men, digging in gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian's God and looking hopefully for life and immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove that we are men. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty? That he is the rightful owner of his own body? That you have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? Is that a question for Republicans? Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty, involving a doubtful application of the principle of justice, hard to be understood? How should I look today in the presence of Americans, dividing and subdividing a discourse to show that men have a natural right to freedom, speaking of it relatively and positively, negatively and affirmatively? To do so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What, am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes? To rob them of their liberty? To work them without wages? To keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men? To beat them with sticks? To flay their flesh with the lash? To load their limbs with irons? To hunt them with dogs? To sell them at auction? To sunder their families? To knock out their teeth? To burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employments for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine, that God did not establish it, that our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There is blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason on such a proposition? They that can may, I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What? To the American slave, is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, Your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation. And you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
Keith David, just incredible. Just very powerful. I'm not going to even try to say anything more after that, brother. That was just remarkable. Thank you very much for joining us today.
I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
You've just been listening to Keith David read this very moving, very apropos for today statement from Frederick Douglass. We also got to look at all that in relation to what's happening to another group of people, immigrants in this country. And that's what we're going to be talking about next. But first, we're going to take a quick musical break, so stay tuned.
Bibles, guns, and flags. Oh, rock me in the cradle, child, carry me to the grave. Pledge allegiance to the doctrine, know you're gonna be saved. My Bibles, guns, and flags.
Welcome back. That was Sonny Meadows with Bibles, Guns, and Flags. Now, as we've been talking about throughout the show, there's been a whole new assault against immigrant peoples across this country. In rural areas, in cities, everywhere you look, there's this assault brewing against immigrant people. And this comes from the highest level of government all the way down to the lowest level of fascist Neanderthals who are currently patrolling the Texas border with Mexico. And out in Murrieta, California, there's been a fascist tide of assaults against young immigrant children brought to a border patrol station for processing in a bus. And they've been confronted by howling mobs of fascists, preventing them from even getting into the Border Patrol station for processing. And they're getting ready to deport them in mass, all these children, back to the countries they came from, which is a question of death. That's, you know, just to be blunt about it. You can decide what you want to do in relation to that, okay? But I want you to hear this from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's a little piece called Why Do People Come Here from All Over the World?
Now I can just hear these reactionary fools saying, well, Bob, answer this. If this country is so terrible, why do people come here from all over the world? Why are so many people trying to get in, not to get out? Maybe we can imagine someone like Vice President Dick Cheney, that crooked-mouthed monster and worldwide mass murderer. Maybe we can imagine him saying something like this. Yes, Bob, why is that? Why? I'll tell you why. Because you have f***ed up the rest of the world even worse than what you have done in this country. You have made it impossible for many people to live in their own countries as part of gaining your riches and power. Besides everything else that I've mentioned, let's look at what they did in the Congo. back in the early 60s and the effect this has had right up to today. The Congo used to be a colony of Belgium. It was the most brutal kind of colonization, working the people literally to death in the mines and other places. They worked them so viciously, literally like slaves, and if they didn't work hard enough, the overseers there would cut off the hands of the people. Finally, after World War II, the people of the Congo got rid of the domination and colonization by Belgium. And they set out to try to build a new country for themselves, and a leader emerged, Lumumba, who was a very popular leader among the people in the Congo. An election was held, and Lumumba won very clearly. But because he was setting out to overcome this legacy of colonialism and all domination by imperialism, the U.S. would not allow it. They maneuvered, they trapped him, they got him into a situation where he was taken and assassinated. And what did they do in place of Lumumba? What did they bring to the people of the Congo? Mobutu, a vicious, brutal tyrant backed by the U.S., kept in power for decades, plundering the people of his own country, building up and amassing tremendous wealth while the people were suffering worse and worse. And then they say, well, see, these people aren't ready for independence. They can't handle their own affairs. Look what happens when they get their independence. Yeah, look what happens. And look deeper and see why. To understand how this system works and how it controls and shapes people's lives, let's look at how people from Mexico and black people end up living alongside each other in somewhere like Watts in Los Angeles or New Jersey or New York City today. It's 1780 or 1800, and someone is walking through their home village in Africa. Maybe they're taking care of a few cattle. Maybe they're tending a few crops. Maybe they're just out for a walk and enjoying the sunny day in the summer. Whatever, all of a sudden they're grabbed and a rope is thrown around them. They're dragged away, never again to see their village or their loved ones. They're transported to a seacoast where they're sold to slave traders, thrown in the hold of a ship under the most horrific and unimaginable conditions, piled together. If you've ever seen drawings, diagrams of slave ships, people packed together, cargo, as they were called. Rats crawling over you day and night, slop at most to eat, never even allowed up on deck to even get any fresh air. If bad conditions arose on the seas, storms developed, the slave ship owners would go among the cargo, the human beings, and decide which one should be thrown overboard so they could save the rest of the cargo so they could make a profit. And through all that horror, you're finally brought to the Americas. Have everything stripped away from you, even your identity. Forced to slave, the people forced to slave away for generations. As the old saying goes, from can't see in the morning till can't see at night. After all the unbelievable horror of what I just described on the slave ship, the Middle Passage, for millions, where millions and perhaps tens of millions died, and those who survived were subjected to these unbelievable conditions of slavery. After generations and centuries of that, finally comes the Civil War. You're promised an end to oppression. You're promised you'll get land and a means for farming the land, 40 acres and a mule. But the promise is broken. After a few years of Reconstruction, in which a few people got some rights and a little bit of land and property, people were stripped of all that and subjected to all the kind of terror and lynching that I've talked about here. This goes on also for generations. The KKK and the rest of it, forcing you to remain on the plantations, terrorizing you into working for the man, being cheated even when you do work. Finally, after World War II, you're driven off the land. You seek a better life. You go to the city or you go to the north. And what do you face? Once again, betrayal. You are segregated once again, terrorized now by the police. You end up in a housing project that's being allowed and deliberately constructed to rot away. In ancient Mexico, in the beginning of the 1500s, the Spanish conquistadores arrive in what they call the New World. The Spanish conquerors destroy the old ways of life and work people to death in the mines and on plantations called haciendas. This old way of life was not free of exploitation and oppression and plunder, but the Spanish did not come to liberate the people or to do away with exploitation, oppression, and plunder. They came to institute their own, an even worse and far more vicious form of exploitation and plunder, literally working people to death in the mines and on the haciendas, destroying their culture, taking away everything from them. About 150 years ago, after Mexico became independent from Spain, the U.S. waged war on Mexico and stole a large part of its territory. One of the main reasons for this is that the slave owners in the southern U.S. needed more land. The U.S. replaced Spain and other European colonial powers as the force dominating and plundering Mexico. The Mexican Revolution in the early part of the 1900s promised land to the peasants, but there was never a fundamental change, and the masses of people were still trapped in a situation of being exploited as poor peasant farmers while their country is plundered by the U.S. Throughout the 20th century, and even more so in recent years, the ever greater domination of farming in Mexico by big American agricultural companies has ruined the livelihood of millions of more peasant farmers in Mexico who were already living in poor and desperate conditions, but were driven further into such desperate conditions, so much so that they could no longer survive by farming. The Mexican government goes into more and more debt to big banks and financial institutions in the rich countries, especially the U.S. And then, at the insistence of the U.S., it cuts off aid to the peasants who are still trying to survive by farming in Mexico. In effect, the government forces them to grow crops that get sold internationally on what is called the world market, which is controlled by the rich countries and their financial institutions. But the Mexican peasants cannot compete in this world market. They cannot make a living. They can barely survive, if they can survive at all, by farming. Writing in our party's newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, in 1994, shortly after an uprising in Chiapas in the southern part of Mexico, Michael Slate gave a sharp example of this. He wrote about what has happened to Mexican agriculture over the past 30 years. Now, agri means having to do with the land, so agriculture is a way of life based on the land. Slate described how over the last 30 years, Mexican agriculture has been greatly damaged by even more deeply mixed in with and dependent on the world market. Peasant farmers growing things not for their own needs and not necessarily for what is needed in Mexico itself, but what can be sold to big buyers all over the world. Once again, a world market dominated by companies controlling billions of dollars. Deeply in debt and under pressure from the World Bank, which itself is dominated by the U.S., the Mexican government promoted crops that could be sold on the world market in order to try to pay off this debt that it was sinking deeper and deeper into. Land and resources were shifted away from basic food production, and the results have been a disaster for the peasants. In Chiapas, for example, most peasants used to grow corn and beans. But over the years, many switched to growing coffee for export. When the price of coffee fell on the world market in 1990, thousands of Mexican peasants were ruined. And in a recent issue of our newspaper, the RW, there's another article detailing more fully how imperialist domination from the U.S. through things like NAFTA and other ways have further ruined the peasants in Mexico. Another thing mentioned in that article is the maquiladoras in Mexico, just inside the border with the U.S. These are factories that are set up by U.S. companies. They move away from the U.S. and put them just over the border in Mexico. And that line there, that border, is the difference between wages that are 10 times higher on the U.S. side and 10 times lower on the Mexico side. And who works in these maquiladoras? People who can no longer live in the interior, in the countryside, on the farmlands of Mexico, and especially many women who are not only brutally exploited, but also sexually harassed on the job, and many have been murdered coming to and from the job in these border areas. But even that's not enough. Now many of the maquiladoras are being closed down on the border, while some new ones are being built further in the interior of Mexico in order to take advantage of people who are impoverished there. And still others are being moved to other places in Asia and elsewhere where people can be worked for even lower wages because they're even more desperate. So through all this, you find yourself having to leave your home and your homeland in Mexico to go to El Norte, the USA, where you face discrimination and exploitation, living in fear every day of the immigration police, La Migra, if you don't have the necessary papers. You too end up in Watts, or in New York City, or New Jersey, or other cities in the US. In the early 80s, there was a movie starring Jack Nicholson and Elpidia Carrillo called The Border, which dramatically showed the kinds of hardships that drive people and the promises and illusions that call them to cross the border from Mexico into the US. And it showed the hardships they suffer once they come to the US, the ways in which they are treated as aliens, and how they are exploited and brutalized in so many ways. The following lines from the theme song of that movie give a powerful sense of what this means. The bitter disappointment that is found in the so-called promised land of the USA, and the many ways in which people are still hemmed in by the visible and invisible borderline. Now, my voice is hoarse, but I'm going to give this a try. There's a land, so I've been told. Every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It's an excerpt taken from his speech that he gave in 2003, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And the title of that excerpt is Why Do People Come Here From All Over the World? And if you want to hear the whole speech that it was taken from, you can do so at revolutiontalk.net. And we're going to have to be real quick with our closing today. So real quick, I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Outer National and Fighting Song.